And we're holding on to days by the Mishnah.
Which page?
We said yes. What?
What's the page?
Nun Gimel Amud Beis, the Mishnah.
Nun Gimel Amud Beis.
We said yesterday that the Kohen Gadol would go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and he's standing between the two poles of the Aron and offering the Torah. So our Mishnah continues. Mishanital Aron, after the Aron was taken away, and we'll see in the Gemara what that phrase means. Evan Hoysa Shami Mos Nevi'im Rishonim. There was a stone there from the time of the Urias Nevi'im. Now, it doesn't mean that it's only there from the time of the Urias Nevi'im. In fact, the Gemara is going to tell us that it's there since the world was created. And especially, we were just talking about before we started about if it is identical with the stone that's there nowadays in the Dome of the Rock, which in that case is part of the natural bedrock of the mountain, then it was always there. What we mean is only in the time of the Nevi'im Rishonim was it first recognized that this has significance. Anyway, Ushsia Hoysin Nikris, it was called the Evan Shsia, as we'll see in the Gemara why it was called that. Gavoya Mina Aretz Sholosh Etzbois, it was three Etzbois higher than the floor. Va'aleo Hayo Noisin, and then he would put the pan of, then he would put the pan of coals and offer the Ketores on top of that. Which would mean, in other words, since we said yesterday that it's supposed to be between the poles of the Aron, the implication is that the rock there was large enough to be where the Aron would have been on it, and also where it would extend toward the east, where the poles of the Aron had been. Again, nowadays that stone is far above this, is far above the floor level over there. But the Radvaz says, if we take that stone is the Evan Shsia, which is what many people hold. Then it would mean the goyim at various times have changed the topography of the mountain, dug in different places and lowered in different places and so forth, and therefore it doesn't necessarily look the way it did when the Beis HaMikdash was standing or before the Beis HaMikdash was built. Continues the mission. So now that the Kohen Gadol is finished with the Ketores, so he put it between the poles of the Aron, as we said in the previous Mishnah, or where there was no Aron, he put it on the Evan Shsia. Now comes the next part of the Avodah. He leaves the Kodesh HaKadoshim. We said he left the Kodesh HaKadoshim. He walked backwards, as we said. Then he goes, now, Notalos Adam Mishayim Maris. Now he goes outside the Heichal. He goes back out to the Azara and takes the blood of the par from the person who was stirring it the whole time. We said previously that he shechted the par. Then he wasn't going to be sprinkling the blood right away. So he gave it to somebody to stand there and stir it so it doesn't congeal. So now he went and took the bowl from the person who had been stewing it the whole time. He went into the same place where he went was before, the Kodesh HaKadoshim. He stood in the same place where he did before, between the poles of the Aron or in front of the Evan Shsia, as the case may be. And he sprinkled that blood there inside the Kodesh HaKadoshim, one up and seven down. Now, what do we mean by up and down? It's not that he means that, it's not that he intends that the one above should be towards the upper edge of the kapodes, and the seven down should be below the thickness of the kapodes. In fact, the blood doesn't anyway touch the kapodes; it all falls onto the ground. Rather, he does it like somebody who's matzlif. Rashi says, I don't know what the word matzlif means. A couple of the Mefarshim say that it means when, actually the Gemara itself is going to say later, that it means when somebody whips. So then Rashi, in other words, knows what it actually means, but where does the Shurdash Salaf come to mean whipping? Rashi says he's not sure. We actually find in Targum Yerushalmi on the Torah, yeah, besides for Targum Onkelos and Targum Yonason, there's also Targum Yerushalmi, which is sort of a variant of Targum Yonason. Anyway, it has, when it talks about Malkus, In Parashas Kisetze, he uses this Shodesh Matzlit. So it means that he's whipping. So what does that mean? There's a couple of answers. Rashi says that what it means is the drops of blood land in a row, one below the other. So in that sense, the comparison to somebody who's whipping is like you begin at the top of the person's back and work your way down. There's a few other explanations, one of them being that the Tosfos Yeshanim said earlier in the Masechta that the Lamaila and Lamata refer to the position of his hand. Lamaila is he has his hand, his palm up with his finger up, and Lamata would be with his palm down and his finger pointing downward. Either way, it's not that the blood just drips off his finger. Each time he dips in his finger and he does a sprinkling with it. He he moves his finger quickly, and the blood falls off and falls onto the ground. The Aruch brings a related idea also. When a person is whipping, he lifts up his hand. When does he actually whip? When he has his hand down closer to the back. So the same way over here, in other words, the Kohen Gadol is using a similar motion when he's doing these sprinklings. So why one above and seven below? That we're going to get to in the Gemara in a couple of blocks. Next, v'chach hayamona, and this is how he would count so that he doesn't lose track of where he's holding in the sprinklings. First, he counts achas, one, for the one above. Achas v'achas, one and one, meaning one up and one down. Achas v'shtayim, achas v'sholosh, achas v'arba, achas v'chomesh, achas v'shesh, achas v'sheva. All of us are familiar with that from the Avodah, from the Seder HaAvodah on Yom Kippur, that when we sing it all. Anyway, so why he does like that? Why doesn't he just count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8? Again, we're going to eventually see in the Gemara why he doesn't do it that way. Once he's done with that, Yotze, he goes out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, v'hinichei arkan hazahav shebehechol, and he places the blood of the par on a golden stand that was in the hechol. He's done with that blood now. Now he's going to go get the blood of the sir. It's interesting that we don't still have somebody standing there and stirring it, even though he's still going to need it for the rest of the applications of blood on the Mizbeach HaZahav. I guess in the few minutes before he comes back and needs it again, I guess we're not that worried that it's going to congeal, whereas before, from when he shechted the pyre until now, was a considerable amount of time. Next. Hey, view Elias a sawyer. Next, they brought him the sawyer.
The sprinkling goes onto where? To the floor of the Kodesh Kodashim?
It goes onto the floor, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Next, hey, view Elias a sawyer. They brought him the sawyer. And when we say they brought him, what we mean is, so you have the place in the Azara where the Seirim had been standing before. We said that the girdle on the Sar Lashem and the Sar Lazazel took place near Shaun Nikanor, on the east side of the Azara. So now they bring him the Sar Lashem closer to the Heichel, the pastures in the same place where he shechted the par much earlier, which, as we said, was closer to the ulam. If the mizbeach is in fact on that side of the azara, then it was literally between the ulam and the mizbeach. If not, then it was a straight line between the space between the ulam and the mizbeach. They would bring him the goat over there, and he would shecht it over there. That way, again, as we said before, he doesn't have to carry the bowl quite that far. Next, shchata, he shechts the goat, the kibble, the mizrakas damai, and he does kabbalah of the blood in a basin. Nichnas the makam to nichnas for amad makam to amad. Now he goes in the third time into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and he goes into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. He stands in the same place as before. V'hizir menu achas the bayla v'shev lamata. He sprinkles again from it the same thing, one above and seven below. And you have Hagoyis Habach adds the same thing as before. If he's doing it like somebody whipping, and he does the same kind of count as before, one and one, etc., all the way up to one and seven. Yotza, then he goes out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and he puts it on a second golden stand that was in the Heichel. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, there weren't two stands. There was only one stand over there. Later on Daf Nun Hei Nun Vav, we're going to discuss why Rabbi Yehuda says that. In other words, according to the Chachamim, what we're saying is there were two stands and they were labeled. You don't want them to mix up which one is which. Because the next thing he has to do is sprinkle them in front of the parochas. So the Tanakhama would say that the two stands are labeled Dama Par and Dama Sir. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda doesn't hold that labeling is good enough, and therefore he says there can only be one stand, and we want to make sure that we don't get the two bowls mixed up. So we'll see in the Gemara. We're going to discuss in the Gemara on Nun Hei Nun Vav what's going on over there. Anyway, therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says, Notel Dama Par, V'hiniach Dama Sir. Therefore, necessarily, since there's only one stand, he has to take the blood of the par and then put down the blood of the sir. That's a continuation of Rabbi Yehuda's statement. Whereas according to the Chachamim, it's the other way around. First, he puts down the sir, then he picks up the par, then he picks up the blood of the par. Which actually, the Magen Avraham points out that there you have a precedent for the concept, we know when we take out two Sifrei Torah, we put the second one down before we do Hagbah on the first one. We put them together, and that would be based on this. That first, we put down the blood of the sir, and then of the par, and only then, according to the we put down the blood of the sir, and only then, according to the chachamim, are we picking up the blood of the par. Although the Magen Avraham says it's not really the same thing, because after all, over here, the point is, according to the chachamim, the reason why you haven't put down the one first and then take the other is in order that he's taking it with his right hand. Because after all, the right hand is supposed to be used for avodah, the left hand not, unless you have no alternative. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, you have no alternative. According to him, you have only one stand. Therefore, of necessity, you're putting down one bowl with your. Therefore, of necessity, you're picking up one bowl with one hand and putting the other one down with the other hand. But according to the Chachamim, since there are two stands, better you should put down the blood of the sir and then be able to pick up the blood of the par with your right hand. Next, either way, so either way, now he has the blood of the par in it. Now he has the bowl with the blood of the par again, according to the Chachamim. Now, according to the Chachamim, you have one stand that has the blood of the sir on it, and the other one is empty because he takes the blood of the par from it. According to the Behoda, there's only the one stand and the blood of the sir is on it. Anyway, he takes the blood of the par now. And he sprinkles some of it on the parochas in front of the aron on the outside, meaning centered in front of where the aron is inside behind that parochas, or again in the second base of mikdash where the aron would have been. Again, achas the mile of a sheva lamata, one up, seven down. Velohe miskaben chola. Again, he didn't intend to do davka above or below. Ela kamatzlif, only like when he's whipping. V'chachayamayna v'chola, and he counted the same way. Achas through achas v'sheva. Here, by the way, not necessarily did all of the drops of blood land on the floor. Some of them may have landed on the poroiches. Later on Daf and Zion, we're going to bring that one of the Chachamim says that after the Churban, he saw the poroiches in Rome, and there were many drops of blood on it. So occasionally the blood may have squirted onto the poroiches. Next, notol dama sir, v'yiniach dama par. Then he puts down the blood of the sir, he puts down the blood of the par. Again, according to Rabbi Yehuda, it necessarily has to be that way. According to the Chachamim, it could be the other way around, that he puts down the blood of the par and then picks up the blood of the sir. Anyway, now he takes the blood of the sir and does exactly the same thing, sprinkles it in front of the aron on the outside. The same thing. So far, we've got 32 sprinklings. 8 of the blood of the par in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, 8 of the blood of the par in the eight of the blood of the par in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, 8 of the blood of the sir in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, 8 of the par in front of the parochas, and 8 of the sir in front of the parochas. Next, ira dama par, l'seich dama sir. The next thing he does is he pours the blood of the par into the blood of the sir, and then pours it back into the other bowl. In other words, he wants to mix the two bloods together. And this way it'll be well mixed. And then in the next Mishnah, we're going to say that he's going to go and apply that mixture to the Mizbeach HaZahav. So the Gemara starts off. So this is what we're talking about, yeah. So far, he didn't do anything near the Mizbeach HaZahav. So far, he did 16 of them in the Kodesh HaKadoshim and 16 of them in front of the Parochas. What he's going to do on the Mizbeach HaZahav is going to be in the next Mishnah. Okay, so the Gemara starts out. Mishan Nignaz Loikatani. Now, the Mishnah did not use the expression Mishan Nignaz Aron, which would imply that the Aron was purposefully hidden away. And we learned yesterday at Braisa that Yeshayahu hid it away 30 odd years before the Churban. Ela mishan nital. Rather, the expression is mishan nital, which means that it was taken, which implies that it was taken by force. Tanya, Commander Omar, Tnan, Commander Omar, Oren Golo Lebavel. Thus, our Mishnah teaches, according to the opinion, that the Oren went in Golos to Bavel with them. The Tanya, as we learn in a Braise, Rabbi Eliezer, Omar, Oren Golo Lebavel. Rabbi Eliezer says the Oren went up going in Golos with them to Bavel. Shenemar, at the turn of the year, in other words, when the year began, or when it was a year since Nebuchadnezzar had last been there, So he'd been there to besiege Yerushalayim and capture Yehoyakim, where eventually Yehoyakim was forced to surrender to Nebuchadnezzar, and he went out and then he died on the way. He appointed his son Yehoyachin or Yechonia as king instead. Now at the turn of the year, he came back. Vayvi'ehu Bavela, he brought him, Yechonia, to Bavel, his son, Imklei Chemdas, Beis Hashem, together with the Kalim of the preciousness of the house of Hashem. So what's more precious than the Oren and the Luchas with the Torah inside? In fact, so Rashi says Klei Chemdas means the Oren, and in fact, a different explanation is, you know, we say in Pirkei Avos, Chaviv Yisrael Shenit Alam Klei Chemda. Kli Chemda is the Torah, so therefore the Oren, which has the Aseret HaDibros and a Sefer Torah in it, is called the Chemdas Beis Hashem. So according to that, then they took that into Golus with them. Now, this that we said that Yoshiyahu hid it is not necessarily a contradiction to that. We learned in Shkalim, also, we learned in Yerushalmi Shkalim, this whole business about what happened to the Oren. One possibility we said over there is that maybe they did hide away the Oren, but then when the Kastim conquered Eretz Yisrael, when they conquered Yerushalayim, that Hashem helped them to actually find where it was hidden underground, and therefore they took it. Now, that's not the only opinion we're going to see. There are different opinions about it, but yeah. Reb Shimon ben Yochai Oren Golol Bavel. Reb Shimon ben Yochai also says that the Oren went into Golos in Bavel. Shenema, based on a different pasuk, over 100 years earlier, you have a story involving Chizkiyahu, where messengers from Bavel came to greet him after he'd been cured of his dangerous illness and the sun had been turned backwards, etc. So, and Chizkiyahu was very happy and he showed them everything in his kingdom, including even it says he showed them the Oren with the Luchos. And the Navi Yeshaya comes to him, and tells him, "You did very wrongly. The result is that all of this is going to end up being taken into Golos and Babel. Lo yivoser davar amar Hashem. Not a thing will be left," says Hashem. And what does the word davar mean? Elo aseres hadibros shaboy. That refers to the aseres hadibros that were in the Oren. So, in other words, Hashem is telling him that even those are going to be taken to Babel. One thing is, by the way, I mean, on one level, that's a punishment for what he did, because, you know, he had no business showing these people such marks of respect, ad kedei kach, of opening up the Oren and showing it to them. The Malbim, I think, on the Pasuk actually says a more balabatish thing. Once he shows them all these treasures in his kingdom, that gives them the idea, hey, there's very rich treasures in Eretz Yehuda. One day we should go and take those. And then that finally came to fruition over 100 years later. But it was made out of gold, right? It was wood made out of wood, plated with gold, and you have kaparis on top of it. So to think of it from their fagurshta point of view, it's just a big golden box. Okay, maybe they had the Kohen bring it out for them. Maybe he just had them see it from a distance. We don't know yet. Okay, anyway. However, the Gemara says, Rabbi Yehuda ben Lakish Omer. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda ben Lakish says, Oren b'mekayme nignaz. No, the Oren, Marshal takes out ben Lakish, so it's just Rabbi Yehuda. So we have Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Shimon, and now we have another Tana and Rabbi Yehuda. Oren b'mekayme nignaz, the Oren was actually hidden in its place, meaning underneath the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Shenema, as the Pasuk says, Vayero Roshe Abadim in a Kodesh of Me'advir. The Pasuk says that when the Kohenim brought the Oren into the Kodesh HaKadoshim in Shloima's times, it says the poles were stretched out long. And Vayero Roshe Abadim, the ends of the poles of the Oren could be seen, Min HaKodesh, from the holy place, Al Pnei Advir, in front of the Dvir. So the Dvir is what we called before the Amatraxin. You have the wall separating in the first Beis Hamikdash between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And as we're going to say later in the Gemara, there was a poroiches over the doorway for privacy. So therefore, the poles were visible in that poroiches. V'lo yero achotza, they weren't actually visible outside. As the Gemara is going to say later, they just formed two bumps in the poroiches. They remain there until this day. So by saying until this day implies that they're still there under the Beis Hamikdash ad hayom hazeh, as the Gemara is going to discuss soon. The Gemara says, now this, by the way, that we're saying, Vayarichu abadim, well, actually, we'll talk about that later. We'll talk about that later. Okay.
When the other people took the Oren, they were punished at high speed. I'm not mentioning that. And they returned.
Right. Well, the difference.
This one, it should have been the same thing.
Right. Well, the difference is, of course, that then there wasn't then Mishkan Shile was destroyed. Fine. But they still, but over here, we're saying, first of all, we're not saying that the Kastim didn't suffer any consequences from it. But if they did, it's not recorded in the Pasuk. But second of all, there's, of course, a difference with the Churban, when the Shechinah, was leaving the Beis Mikdash. All right. However, the Gemara says, a pliga de'ula. Okay, so now this that we just said, that Rav Shimon says Oren Golol Abavel, that disagrees with Ula's version of what Rav Shimon said. So far we have Rav Eliezer saying Oren Golol Abavel. We had Rav Shimon also saying Oren Golol Abavel. Then we have Rav Yehuda saying that Oren Mimkoim Nignaz, that was buried underground under the Bismuth. So now this that we said, that Rav Shimon holds, Rav Shimon Vayachoy holds, that the Oren was taken to Bavel, that disagrees with Ula's version of the story. The Omar Ula, Shor Rav Masya ben Chorosh as Rav Shimon ben Yechoy ben Roimi. Rav Masya ben Chorosh asked Rav Shimon ben Yechoy in Roimi. Now, Roimi Bepashtus means Rome. Rav Masya ben Chorosh was the Rav and the Rosh Hashiva there. And Rav Shimon ben Yechoy at one point visited Rome. The Gemara tells us in Me'ilah a whole story where there was some very serious gzeiros that had been enacted against the Jewish people, and Rav Shimon went there together with Rav Elazar and Rav Yosi to be mevatel the gzeiros, and eventually they were successful. So now, while Rav Shimon was in Rome, then Rav Masi ben Chorosh took the opportunity to ask him this question. Given that Rabbi Eliezer has taught us, based on two different psukim, that the Oren went to in Golos to Babel, and the Gemara interjects, before we continue with Rabbi Masya ben Chorosh's question, let's understand what's the second pasuk that Rabbi Eliezer quoted. The first one we said, since it says Klei Chemdas Beis Hashem, then Rabbi Eliezer understood that to mean the Oren. It says, "Vayvi'er bavel and klei chemnas beis Hashem." Shnia ma'hi. What is the second one that Rabbi Eliezer uses as a proof for that? Dichtiv a pasuk in Eicha, "Vayetze mibas Tzion kol hadara." They went out from the daughter of Tzion, meaning the Jewish people collectively. They went out kol hadara, all of her beauty. And my kol hadara means chadara, means the thing that was in the innermost room of the meaning in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So according to that, that's another, so Vayetze, it went out, so that's another, by the Churban, so that's another proof that Rabbi Eliezer uses that the Oren was taken to Babel. So now, Rabbi Masi ben Chorosh asked Rabbi Shimon, Ata Mata Omer, what do you say? Do you agree with that? Omer Loi, and according to this version, Rabbi Shimon tells him, Oren b'mekoyim nignaz. The Oren was hidden in the same place, underneath the same place where it was before, again, in the vaults under the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Which means that he agrees with Rabbi Yehuda. So again, this is what we're saying. The Braisa that we quoted said that Rav Shimon says Oren Golol Abavel. Now, according to Ula's version, actually Rav Shimon is one of the ones who says that the Oren was hidden underneath the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Shenema Vayarich Rabadim. We're going with the same pasuk that we said before, that the Badim, that the poles of the Oren were extended, and that they were there Ada Yemazeh, which means that they're still there until this very day. So Omale Rabba Ula, however, Rabba asks Ula, my mashma. So what is Rav Shimon saying? That it's there until this day, Dichtiv Vayir Sham Ada Yemazeh, only because it says in the pasuk Ada Yemazeh. Are you telling me V'chol Hecha Dichtiv Ada Yemazeh La'olam Hu? You're telling me whenever it says about something, Ada Yemazeh means necessarily that it's forever? V'aksiv, you have a pasuk in Shoftim, V'esa Yivusi Yoshev Yerushalayim Loi Harishu Bnei Vinyamin. The Yevusim, the Goyim who lived in Yerushalayim, Bnei Binyamin did not dispossess them. Like this, Yerushalayim was partly in the territory of Yehuda and partly in the territory of Binyamin. So Bnei Binyamin did not work to get the Yevusim out of their part. So the Yevusi lived among the Bnei Binyamin in Yerushalayim until this very day. So what do you mean? Until this very day means they never went into Golus? Are you telling me these Yevusim and Bnei Binyamin never went into Golus? Of course not. V'hotanya, we learn in a Braisa. Rabbi Yehuda, I'm a chamishim u'shtayim shana le'ovei ish b'Yehuda. During the 52 years after the Churban, no person passed through Yehuda. So what happened? You had Nebuchadnezzar became king and then conquered Eretz Yisrael. We said that there's 70 years of Golos Babel, but how the 70 years are counted, there's a few different possibilities, and there were different stages in those 70 years. You had 70 years after Nebuchadnezzar began his empire, then his empire was overthrown in Belshazzar's times after the writing on the wall, after the handwriting on the wall. The next year Nebuchadnezzar conquered Eretz Yisrael. A few years later, Nebuchadnezzar conquered Eretz Yisrael, and from then you had 70 years from then brings us to when Kodesh proclaimed that the Jewish people can go and start rebuilding the second Beis Hamikdash. Then you have other ones, you have Golos Yechonia, and you have the actual Churban. 70 years after the actual Churban, they started the actual rebuilding of the second Beis Hamikdash and completed it without any problems. Anyway, so what happens after the Churban, so you have a few people left in Eretz Yisrael with Gedaliah ben Achikam. A few weeks later, Gedaliah is assassinated, and all of them are scared, and they all run off to Mitzrayim. In fact, Yirmiyahu was with them, and he warned them not to stay here in Eretz Yisrael, and you'll be safe. But they claim that he doesn't know what he's talking about, and they all wound up going to Mitzrayim. So now, for the next 52 years after that, from then until Kodesh made his proclamation, and people were able to go and start rebuilding Eretz Yisrael and rebuilding the second Beis Hamikdash, for those 52 years, we're saying Loi Ova Ish Yehuda, no human being passed through Eretz Yehuda. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, Al Hahorim Asab B'chivanehi, the Pasuk says in Yirmiyah, it's an Aftorah of Tisha B'Av morning, on the mountains, or because of the mountains, I will raise up a cry and a wailing, about the Ois Midbar, and about the beautiful places of the desert, Kina, I'll make a mourning, Ki Nitzitzu Mibli Yishayva, because they've been destroyed and no person is passing through, V'loi Shomu Keil Mikne, they didn't even hear the sound of any grazing, of any animals, of any domestic animals, from the birds of the heavens until the animals, meaning every living creature, nodadu halachu, they wandered and they went away. And the word behema, gematria chamishin or shtayim havu, the word behema is gematria 52. In other words, the point is, once it says in the earlier in the pasuk kil mikne, then we know that there were no animals there. So when it says va'ad behema nodadu halachu, it means up till 52 years had passed, the gematria behema, everything wandered away. So there's no people or animals living in that area for 52 years. It's completely desolate. Yehuda includes the area of Yerushalayim. So no human beings passed through, and no animals even. It was Min HaShemayim that it should be completely desolate. The Tanya, and we learn in a Braisa, Rabbi Yosiyam, Sheva Shonim Niskaima Gofris Vamelach the Eretz Yisrael. For 7 years, Eretz Yisrael was filled with sulfur and salt, almost like when Sodom was destroyed. And we know, as the Pasuk says, you have a Pasuk in Parashas Nitzavim, where Moshe warns the Jewish people, if you don't do what Hashem wants and you end up going into Golos, then the Goyim are going to come and look and they're going to say, what's going on over here? Gofritz or Malach Srefa Kalautza, and how is it that such a beautiful, fertile land became like this? And they're going to realize that it's because of what you did. So this occurred for 7 years, sometime during those 52 years, you had 7 years of that. My time at Rabbi Yossi. So Rabbi Yochanan says, where does Rabbi Yossi get the 7 years from? Asya bris. We make a gzera shava on the word bris. Ksiv hocha v'higri bris l'rabim shavua echad. There's a pasuk in Daniel that says he will make a powerful bris for the sorim for 7 years. So in context, what it means is something like that the Romans are going to make a peace treaty with the Jewish people, which is supposed to last for 7 years, but then halfway through it, they're going to break their peace treaty and come and invade. But the part of his nevuah about what's going to happen in future times, hundreds of years and thousands of years after him. But here we're understanding that it means that Hashem made the bris, the gofer tzva melach, which uses the word bris in that connection, that it should be overpower Eretz Yisrael for 7 years. Shavua echad means 1 7-year period. There, when it talks about the gofer tzva melach, it says that the goyim are going to realize that this is because they abandoned the bris of Hashem. So you see that the Gofritz from Malach lasted for 7 years. Anyway, the point is that you can't say, therefore, when it says that the Yevusi lived with Binyamin and Yerushalayim Ada Yemazeh, that it means continuous, because everybody went in Golos. Ula answers, Hocha Ksiv Shom, Hocha Lo Ksiv Shom. The difference is, because over here, it says Vayiyu Shom, that the Oren was there, that the poles of the Oren are there, Ada Yemazeh, whereas by the Yevusi and Bnei Binyamin, doesn't say Shom, it just says that they lived in Yerushalayim Ada Yemazeh. So it can mean, in other words, that so there Ada Yemazeh doesn't literally have to be until this very day. So the question still is, so you're telling me that any time it says Shom, then it means and Ada Yemazeh, then it means for forever. Maisvi, we have another contradiction. A pasuk in Divrei Yomim describes, so you have like this, Shevet Shimon, to begin with, got their territory within Shevet Yehuda. When the territories were given out to the Shvatim, it turned out that Yehuda's territory was at the time much larger than the Shevet needed. that come into Eretz Yisrael. There's only about 76,000 men between 20 and 60 years old, and it's a very large territory that was given to Yehuda. So therefore, they took some of that territory and gave it to a different Shevet, and the girdle came up that it was Shevet Shimon. And that way it was fulfilled. What it says in the Pasuk, how can be Yaakov, v'afitzim v'Yisrael? If they don't get a territory of their own, they only get a territory within another Shevet. Anyway, the deal was that it was only supposed to be temporary. Eventually, when Shevet Yehuda grows, then they're going to be entitled to take that over. Eventually, that taka happened. So they told Shevet Shimon to take a hike. So now the Pasuk describes what happened. Various groups of Shevet Shimon went to different places. So one of them, it says, U'mehem min b'nei Shimon hochu l'haus Seir. Of them, some of these people from Shimon went to Haus Seir, where the Adonim lived. Anoshim chamesh meis, there were 500 men. Uflatio na'ario refoya v'uzio b'nei yishi b'roshem. They were led by these people. And the Pasuk continues, V'yakos she'edus ha'pleitol ha'molik. Over there, they struck and killed the remaining fugitives from Amalek. So you had the Amalekim who had been killed by Shaul in his war, although he didn't finish the job. You have the ones that David killed in a war against them. But now you had some survivors. So now these people of Shimon killed those survivors as well. And they lived in that territory. So there it says Shom, and it says Adayim Azeh. And we know that it can't be that these Bnei Shimon are still living there now, because Chvar Ola Sancheid of Melech Asher, Sancheid of Melech Asher has already come with Bilbo Kol HaRotzes and confused and moved around all the different countries and all the different people in those countries. Shenemar, the Pasuk says, V'osir Gvulis Amim. Sancheid says on himself, I remove the borders of the nations, V'asudosehem Sheisesi, and I plundered their treasures. So there, and he says that I did that to the whole world. Well, his reason was that this way the people are less likely to rebel against him. We find most explicitly that he did that in Eretz Yisrael. He took the Aseres HaShavatim into Golos, and then he replaced them with people from various cities in Babel. The idea was, it's not their territory, therefore they're less likely to be comfortable over there. They don't know all the secret hiding spots and the cloud. They're less comfortable. They're more ill at ease because they're not in their place. The language they'll bring with them. But in other words, the point is that the point is this way they're less likely to rebel because they're less likely to be, you know, we're in our place. If this is our land, therefore we should rebel.
He
was a strong king, but he wanted to make sure. Yeah. So Zuma says true of him. In that case, that's a contradiction. So therefore, we have to say that Adayim Azeh, even Shom Adayim Azeh, does not necessarily mean literally until this day. Now, with that said, though, Gilyan Ashas refers over here to a Gemara in Soita that talks about the famous city of Luz, where the Malach HaMavos can't even get into the city, and Sancheiriv never conquered it, and then Nebuchadnezzar never conquered it, and it really is there, Adayim Azeh. And Rashi explains that that's based on the fact that it says Adayim Azeh about it. Based on our Gemara over here, that doesn't seem to work. So he leaves it as Tzorech Iyun. The Noda B'Yehuda actually has a couple of Shuvos on this subject. In his time, you had Rabbi Yeshaya Berlin, who made many additions to Masoret HaShas and also wrote a few other things, showing an incredible knowledge of everything in Torah and of all the Ma'ariv Mekomos and everything. So he writes to the Noda B'Yehuda, asking him b'chlal, the main part of his question is about when it says about certain mitzvahs, Chukas Olam Medodes Seichem, what is that adding that we wouldn't have known otherwise? And the Noda B'Yehuda goes through them one by one and explains. Then at the end, he says, as far as this Adayim Azeh, he says, what do we do with that Gemara and that Rashi in Soita? He says, the idea would be that what we're saying is the Yevusim continued to live among Bnei Binyamin wherever they were. So first of all, he says, yeah, all Gemara may be disagreeing with the Gemara in Soita, that they were saying Adayim Azeh necessarily means Adayim Azeh, and that particular city of Luz was never conquered by Sancheiriv and so forth, whereas here we're saying that no, just because it says Adayim Azeh doesn't mean that Sancheiriv or Nebuchadnezzar didn't conquer it. But then he goes on to say that what we mean is wherever the Bnei Binyamin went, even in Golos, they still have the Yevusim living together with them. And then the Rabbi Yeshaya wrote back and said, on the face of it, the Pasuk says, B'Yerushalayim, and the Noda B'Yehuda writes back with another tshuva, back to back with the first one, explaining that as well. Anyway, so it could be, though, based on that, it seems that in fact this Gemara may be disagreeing with the Gemara in Soita.
This place
wasn't familiar. So it's someplace Eretz Achitim, the Pasuk calls it. Where it is exactly, I don't think I have. Okay. Next. So far we have the following opinions. We have Rabbi Eliezer saying Oren Golol Abavel. We have Rabbi Yehuda saying Oren B'mekoyim Nignaz, that was hidden under the Kodesh HaKadoshim. We have Rabbi Shimon, who in one version he says also Oren Golol Abavel, and in the second version he says that it stayed under the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Now we have another opinion. Amar Rav Nachman, Tana, we learn in a Braisa, V'chachamim Oren V'lishkas Dira Eitzim Hayogonuz, the Oren was hidden under the Lishka of the Beis Mikdash, where they kept the wood, where they kept the wood sword, which was one of the four chambers in the Ezras Noshim. You have in the corners of the Ezras Noshim, you have the four large chambers, one for wood, one for the Metzaroyim, one for the Nazirim, and so forth. So one of them, so under the one for the wood, is where the Aron was buried. We learned it in Shkolim a couple of months ago. Yeah. So the Nachman Yitzchok says, yes, in fact, we have a Mishnah that expresses that it was hidden under the Lishkas Dereitzim. And we said, it happened that once that a Koyen was playing around, Rashi says, Misasik means the teal of Schoik, like he's walking around and playing around, as the Gemara is going to soon say, with his axe. So he's not really acting the way that he should in the Beis Mikdash anyway. He noticed one floor tile that looked different than the other one. Different in that Rashi says he saw it looked a little bit higher, so it was as if it had been taken out and then set back into the floor, but it hadn't been set back in all the way. When we learned this in Shkolim, we learned a different explanation that some of the Mephoshim say it was different in color, as though like the fire of the Aron changed it to a different color. Anyway, he came and told his fellow Kohen, he didn't even manage to finish saying it over until his neshama left him. And they knew very clearly that the Aron is buried. We said in the mission over there, in fact, Rabbi Gamliel's family agreed with that, and therefore, when they bowed wherever they went in the Beis Mikdash, they would bow a 14th time. We said there were 13 bowings corresponding to the 13 breaches that the Greeks made in the Surdig, or corresponding to the 13 gates of the Azara. So they would bow a 14th time over here by Lishkas Dereitzim, because that was their family Masada that the Aron is hidden over there. Which, by the way, I mean, Mephoshim point out that doesn't necessarily have to contradict the one about it being buried under the Kodesh HaKadoshim. It could have been a long tunnel where the entrance to the tunnel was in the Lishkas Dira Eitzim, and the end of the tunnel is under the Kodesh HaKadoshim.
One tile is not enough for the whole earth.
Well, it depends on the size of the tiles, right? If the tiles were very large, then. My Hava Ovid. So the question is, what was this Kohen Gadol doing when we say Misasik? Amar Rav Chelba Misasik B'Kardumoy Hoya. He was playing around with his axe. So he hadn't, no, this is a regular Kohen. Tonad ve Rabbi Shmuel, we learn in a braisa from the Yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel, Shnei Kohen and Bale Mumen Hoyim Aslim Be'etzim, a different version of the story, or a different story. Two Kohen and Bale Mumen were checking the wood in the Lishkas Dira Eitzim for worms, because you're not allowed to, and that's what they have the axes for, is if necessary, they're going to cut away the part of the wood that has worms in it. The din is, if the wood is dry, all they have to do is remove the area that has the worm in it. If the wood is moist, then they have to cut out that whole part that has the worms in it. Anyway, so for that purpose, they had an axe. So two of them were working on this, and then they're Bali Mumim, because if they're Koyanim Tmimim, they would be doing the Avodah. But like this, since they're Bali Mumim, this is the only thing they can do. So they would do that. So they were doing that. The Nishmeter Kardumay Shal Echad Mehem, one of them dropped his axe, and it landed on that spot. And a fire came and consumed it or him. So either it means that the fire consumed him for being careless, or it means it consumed it. The axe because it fell over there. Either way, that shows that the Aron is buried under that the Aron is buried under the Lishkas Direi. Rabbi Yehuda Rum. Now, Rabbi Yehuda pointed out, going back to the pasuk that we said before, we said Vayarichu Abadim, we said the Badim were extended and they were visible through the Parechas, but they weren't visible. So Rabbi Yehuda pointed out, the pasuk seems to contradict itself. Ksiv Vayero Roshe Abadim, first it says the ends of the Badim were visible, implying that you could actually see them from the Hekel. But it says they could not be seen from the outside. So what is it? Could they be seen or could they not be seen? Okay, it's at Nirin Ve'en Nirin. The answer is it means they could be seen but not seen. In other words, that you could see how they stick. You could see the protrusions of them behind the parochas, but you didn't see the actual thing. You didn't see the actual gold of them themselves. Tani Namihochi. We learn similarly in the Braisa when the pasuk says Vayiro Roshe Abadim, the ends of the Badim were visible. Yochol Loyu Zozin Nemkayman. So first of all, you would think that the poles of the Aron do not move from their place. Now, the Pasuk does tell us that lo yasuru mimenu, the poles of the Aron are not to be moved from their place. So you would think that means that, they didn't move them from their place b'chlal. Tamad lema v'yarichu abadim, therefore it says the badim were extended. Now, one way of understanding that is, we're going to learn later on in the Masechta, that the poles of the Aron were thicker on the ends. So they were made in such a way that they're not going to, they can be slid back and forth. They can be slid back and forth between the rings, but they can't be taken completely out of the rings except with great difficulty, which fine, because there's a loisa in the Torah not to take them out anyway. They were actually moved. In other words, they were slid back and forth in such a way that they would stick out toward the front of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. There is a different explanation also that Vayarichu Abadim means V'derech Nes, the Badim became longer. Like this, the Aron is in the middle of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. There's 10 Amos from the 10 Amos in front of it, because we say Makam Aron Eina Min Amida, the Aron does not actually take up physical space in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So you have 10 Amos you need from the Aron until the front of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. At least an amma and a half for the width of the Aron, because the Aron was an amma and a half wide, and a little bit past that in order that the badim still stick out the other end. So you have, they're a minimum of 12 amas long. So does that mean to begin with they were made at least 12 amas long, or does it mean that a nest happened and they were extended to be long in order that they should stick out into the Kurit? You would think then if it says that they were visible from the outside, it means they actually tore through the parechas, and there were actually holes in the parechas through which you can see the ends of the badim. No, therefore, the pasuk says they were not visible from the outside. So they would push and they would stick out. The yotzin, the parechas, they would stick out of the parechas. So you look at the parechas, you would see two bumps over there, but you wouldn't see the actual badim. So they resemble the two breasts of a woman underneath her blouse. As the pasuk says, "Sir Hamur Dirty Li, my beloved in Shir Hashirim, that means Hashem, is like a bundle of mur, a bundle of spices for me, representing the Ketores, among other things. Bein Shaddai Yolin, he rests between my breasts." So we see that the two poles of the Aron, which is where the Ketores was offered, are compared to breasts. Marsha points out, in fact, the word Bein Shaddai can be rearranged to spell Shnei Bade. So it really represents the two bottom of the Aron. Okay, continues the Gemara. More on this topic. So we're saying that the Aron is like, the Aron was made to look like breasts, and it shows the tremendous closeness that Hashem and the Jewish people have, like a husband to wife. So Amar of Ketina, so the Ketina says in this connection, "V'shar shahoy Yisrael oylem l'regel," when the Jewish people would come on aliyah l'regel, "megalim l'henes ha-parechas," the Kohenim would roll aside the parechas, they would show them the kruvim are hugging each other. And they would tell them, look how precious you are in front of Hashem, like a husband and wife are to each other. Yeah, so they're opening the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and how they're able to see it. I mean, b'chlal, Yisrael, on the face of it, the Yisraelim have to be pretty far away. Yeah, so either it means, yeah, they can see from a distance. It would be a distance of about 150 amos, which is about 230 feet according to Rabbi Avraham Chaim Nahr, about 300 feet according to the Chazon Ish. Fine, it's a distance, but they can still see it. But the other possibility is maybe they were allowed to come a little bit closer. You know, maybe they were allowed to come, let's say, until the area of the Mizbeach or something, which saves a couple of dozen amos. Anyway, Masiv Rav Chista. So Rav Chista says, what do you mean? You're allowing that we can open up the Parochas and we can see the Aron just like that? At the end of Parashas Bamidbar, it describes how they would pack up the kalim of the Mishkan for transport during the years in the Midbar. What? And they weren't supposed to look. And the pasuk says, "V'lo yavoyu l'ras kevala asakodesh." It says that the Levim are not even allowed to come and see and watch as the kalim are being packed. The Kohenim have to pack them up, and only after they're packed do the Kohenim, and only after they're covered do the Levim come and start doing their jobs. But Amar of Yehuda Amar Rab, what does it mean? Kevala asakodesh means v'shasach nosas kalim l'nartik shalahen. Means when the kalim are being put into their respective coverings. So all of a sudden now we're saying that they're opening up the parochas and showing the Aron to the whole Jewish people. Amar of Nachman, Moshal l'kala. So Rav Nachman says, yes, but it's like, think of it the way it is with a kala and her chosim. calls man shehi beveis aviya, as long as she's living in her father's home, in other words, during the kiddushin, before they've actually fully gotten married, snua mibayla, then she's very tsnia stick around her husband. So she's embarrassed for, she's shy around her husband. Kivin shebosel beis chamia ain it snua mibayla. Once she comes to her father-in-law's house, in other words, once they have nisuin and now they're fully married, then she's not so shy around her husband. So the same way, while the Jewish people were in the Midbar, there wasn't yet such a gilui shechina. Therefore, you have to be careful not to look at the kelim when you're not supposed to. But after they came to the Beis Mikdash, it's like now we're in our marital home. So therefore, now they're able to be more, so to speak, familiar with each other, and therefore we're able to see the poro, therefore we're able to see the oren and not have a problem. So they showed the shulchan with the lachan upon him, right? So that's how they did it. The Gemara says, "Masiv Rav Chama bar Rav Ketina." Rav Chama bar Rav Ketina says, "What about though? We said in our Mishnah, Ma'aseh b'Koyin Echad Shoyim Masasik. Well, you had not in our Mishnah. We had the Mishnah that we quoted from Shkolim. They had a Koyin and was playing around over there with an axe." And before he had a chance to tell them where the Oren is, and he passed away. Now, why would that be? The pasuk is because they're not supposed to look at the Oren. So then you see that again. So you see, even when the Beis Mikdash is standing, they can't look at the Oren. Amalei. So Rav Ketina answers, Nisgar Shakamrit. You're talking about the equivalent of them getting divorced and then getting remarried. That's the second Beis Mikdash, as if Hashem divorced the Jewish people, Chas V'Shalom, and then remarried them. Now it's not really. In fact, you have a Gemara in Sanhedrin where people come to Yechezkel and argue, since Hashem divorced us, we can do whatever we want. And he tells them, no, Hashem didn't truly divorce you, but in a certain sense, it's like a separation, whatever. And now they came back together. So yeah, now they're shy. Now they're shy around each other again, because now they're like walking on eggshells around each other, so as not to hurt each other again. Then they go back to the original level of closeness that there was between them, where they're still careful and shy around each other. So then, in other words, so in the first Beis Mikdash they could see the Aron, in the second Beis Mikdash they couldn't. This story with the Koyan and the axe was in the second Beis Mikdash, obviously, right? It was in. So the Gemara asks, "B'maya skinan?" This that we said that the Kohenim would roll up the Parechas and show everybody the Oren and show everybody the Kruvim. B'maya skinan? Which Beis Mikdash are we talking about? In name of a Mikdash Rishon, do we mean the first Beis Mikdash? Mi havoi Parechas? Was there a Parechas? The assumption of the Gemara at this point is that there was a wall, and in the middle of the wall there was a door. So it doesn't say nothing about a Parechas. El of a Mikdash Sheni, was it in the second Beis Mikdash? Mi havu kruvim, were there the kruvim over there? The pashtos, the kruvim that we're talking about, are either, Rashi says, are the kruvim, the large wooden gold-plated kruvim that Shlomo made, standing on the floor of the Kodesh HaKadoshim and covering over the Aron. The pashtos, those are the kruvim that they're showing to the people. So maybe they're talking not showing them the Aron, maybe they're only showing them those kruvim. The point is, those didn't exist in the second Beis Mikdash. Because again, when the Aron was hidden away, the pashtos, those went with it also. They were there in order to like stand guard over the Aron. So no Aron, no Kruvin. In fact, we learned at the end of the first Perek that after that when the things that were hidden away at the end of the first Beis Mikdash and weren't there in the second Beis Mikdash include Aron, Kaporis, or Kruvim. Now, why are we listing the Kruvim separately? Because these are these Kruvim, these large wooden gold-plated Kruvim, yeah. So in the first Beis Mikdash on the face of it, there's no Parechas. In the second Beis Mikdash on the face of it, there's no Kruvim. So this story that was saying that they would roll up the Parechas and show everybody how the Kruvim are embracing each other, when did this happen? The answer is, we are talking about the first Beis Mikdash. Or my Parechas, which Parechas do we mean? Parechas de Bavi. We mean the Parechas in that were in front of the doorways. In other words, even though there were doors in the doorways, there was also a Parechas. Yeah, that Amar Rav Zeira, Amar Rav. As in fact, Rav Zeira says in the name of Rav, Shloisha also Parechas Hayu B'Mikdash. There were 13 Parechas in throughout the Beis Mikdash complex. Shiva Keneged Shiva Sharim. There were 7 in front of the 7 gates. The idea of a pashtus would be in the morning, the overnight gates would be locked, but in the morning when they opened up the gates, then they would have the Parechas in over them for tznius. This way, people are not just gazing in to the Beis Mikdash all the time. So 7 for the 7 main gates of the Azara, Shtayim, then you have another 2, Achas the Pischa Shal Heichel, the Achas the Pischa Shal Ulam, 1 hanging in front of the Heichel and the other 1 hanging in front of the Ulam. So the 1 in front of the Ulam actually served instead of a door, because the Ulam had no doorway. It was just a big, it was just completely open in front. But the Heichel had a door, but again, the Parechas was there throughout the day when the door was open. So that's nine so far. Shtayim b'dvir, then you have two in the dvir, the amatraxin, the two parechasin that we said the other day that the Kohen Gadol would walk through, would walk between them to reach the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Or shtayim connect them ba'aliyah, and two above those in the attic, in the second floor of the Beis Mikdash. There was also, there was a room over there corresponding to the Kodesh, and a room corresponding to the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And there was a parechas separating them. I mean, what they keep up there, we don't know. We do know that when they needed to repair things in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, then they would send down people in the boxes over there through holes in the ceiling. With the Kodesh, maybe they did it. No, the Kodesh, they wouldn't need to do that. But I guess once they need a room above the Kodesh HaKadoshim, then they need a room above the Kodesh as well. So that's the 13. So the point is, in other words, there was, even in the first Beis Mikdash, now this is talking about the second Beis Mikdash, because we're saying two Pareichas, but still the point is that we see that there were Pareichas in front of gates, even where there's a door, there's still a Pareichas in front of it. So the same way, even in the first Beis Mikdash, there was a door going into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, a door in the wall, nevertheless, there was also a Pareichas over it.
Wouldn't we say that the corridor was too high, you only had a Pareichas?
No, that's what we said. The Ulam had the entryway of it was 40 amas tall and 20 amas wide, and instead of having a door there, they had only a parochus hanging there of 40 by 20. Okay. Fine. Rav Acha ba Yaakov says you don't need to answer that. La'olam mikdash sheni. You can answer instead that the kruvim that they showed the Jewish people are in fact in the second mitzvah. Now, what it is we're not talking about the kruvim. We're not talking about the kruvim on top of the aron, and we're not talking about the freestanding kruvim that Shlomo made. Rather, we're talking about the kruvim that were on the walls. So Rashi describes they were painted or engraved on the walls. You had like this: the walls of the Beis Hamikdash were made out of stone. The stone had a wooden coating on top of it. They paneled over the stone wood, and then they covered the wood with gold. The reason is Rashi mentions in a few places gold won't stick well to stone. So if they tried to put gold directly on the stone, it wouldn't stay. Therefore, they had the wood there to be a base for the gold. Anyway, the point is, as we're going to go on to say now, as we're going to quote from a pasuk, the walls were decorated with images of, among other things, kruvim, and those kruvim also had the same thing where they would be embracing each other, and that would be what they'd show to the Jewish people, that look how precious you are before Hashem. And those existed still in the second Beis Mikdash, even though the first Beis Mikdash was set on fire. The Gemara elsewhere mentions, I think the Yerushalmi mentioned, that the foundations of the walls still survived, therefore they were able to see more or less where everything was built. And apparently, based on what we're saying in the Gemara over here, some of the bottom parts of the walls and the wood on them also survived, and therefore they had them in the second Beis Mikdash. Dichtiv, as the Pasuk says, when Shlomo is building the first Beis Mikdash, the Eis Kokire Sabayis Mesav Kola, all of the walls of the house, of the Heichol and the Kodesh HaKadoshim, he had surrounded with images of networks. It actually describes the Shosses of Kliyas, networks and braids, so like as a decoration, as a decorative motif. Kruvim b'simoris, there were kruvim and palm trees, ufturei tzitzim, and open buds of flowers, v'tzipa zahav, and he plated it with gold, miyusha ala machuka, straight on top of what was carved. In other words, Rashi explains on the pasuk that carvings on the wall of these various designs, and then you have the gold was made in such a way that it would go along the contours of those engravings. Because otherwise, if you just have the gold flat, it's going to cover up the engravings. So the idea was that the gold was put over the engravings and hammered in place in such a way that you could still see the engravings and the carvings and whatever would be visible through the gold. So the point is that we see that there were kruvim, among other things, engraved or painted or whatever on the walls over there, and therefore that was what they would show the Jewish people, that they'd be hugging each other.
Say, oh, it's only growing, it always is that way.
We're not necessarily saying that they would show the people the nest that happened. The point is they would show the people, look, that we in the Kodesh HaKadoshim of all places, we have such a decorative motif of a husband and wife embracing each other all over the place. That shows that the relationship that Hashem wants to have with you. And Uchtiv, and another pasuk in that connection says, Kima'ar ish v'loyos, actually it's the next pasuk, says, Kima'ar ish v'loyos, So what is my kamar ishvalayas? What does that phrase mean? Some mafreshim on the pasuk means it explains something like that they had wreaths and decorations of that all over the place. But the Gemara explains, Amar Rabba Shila, Barav Shila, ki ish hamu'ura bilavoya shaloi. Means that the design was like a person who's hugging his levoya, his wife who accompanies him. So they had images of that of a man and his wife hugging. Again, to represent the preciousness of the Jewish people to Hashem. Now, yes, in other places, the Gemara in Bava Basra does mention this idea that it depends whether Oisin Ritzonish Shalmakim or not. That when Oisin Ritzonish Shalmakim, they would be hugging, and when Ein Oisin Ritzonish Shalmakim, they would not. One possibility is, again, the Gemara discusses over there, that may have applied only to the Kruvim that Shlomo made. Not necessarily does that apply to the ones on the walls, which is what we're talking about over here. Although some of Foshim say there's no difference. But even if they were painted, or even if they were engraved, the same way, and the other ones were made out of wood and plated with gold. But then, they wouldn't move either. But a nest would happen, and they would. We're going to say that now. Just a second. You can see over here also. There's a very, very long Tosfos. You look on Omer Aleph at the beginning of that Tosfos. You don't realize what you're getting yourself into. You don't realize it doesn't look that long. But then you come. I heard this kind of thing. Somebody once called this kind of thing an iceberg Tosfos. Like most of it is underwater. You don't realize until you turn the page. Anyway, this Tosfos is actually taken almost word for word from a tshuva of Maharam Rutenberg. Each of the Tosfos on different Masechtos were written by different Balei HaTosfos, and then people have worked to try and figure out who wrote which one. The Tosfos on Yoma were written by Maharam Rutenberg, and here we have more or less a tshuva of his that's incorporated into Tosfos. Tosfos Yeshanim then would be a different collection of Tosfos that was put together in one of the other yeshivas. Anyway, he discusses the question, since we're talking about over here these images of the Kruvim that were painted or designed on the walls of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, what are the relevant dinim as far as making pictures in Machzorim? In those times, it was a very common thing. You have nowadays, they have various examples in museums and libraries all over the world, these beautiful illustrated and illuminated machzorim and sedurim and whatever. What's the dinim about that? They're drawing chayas and birds and whatever. What's the din? So first he starts by saying it's not good because then you're focusing on those and you're not focusing on Hashem. But as far as an issur, he goes into a long discussion of what kinds of images are usur and what's mutter. Among other things, he says that images that are painted, There's never an issur, only if they're three-dimensional. And when they're three-dimensional, then you have certain dinim. You're not allowed to have three-dimensional images of people and of the Chayas HaKodesh and certain other things. Now, not everybody agrees with Maharam Rutenberg on that. There are other Rishonim who learn that even two-dimensional images are a problem, and therefore this is one reason why many, many G'dayli Yisrael throughout the generation did not want their pictures painted or photographed because of that, because of the concern about surahs of people. And also, you have, for example, Tzemach Tzedek, where the goy had to sneak in and peek in through the window on Shabbos to draw a picture of him. They say something similar about the Chacham Tzvi, that they had to like catch him unawares and be able to paint a picture of him and so forth. Or the other possibility is you draw an incomplete figure. You leave out some part of it. There's an interesting thing in that connection worth mentioning of all these various illuminated Haggadahs and Machzorim and what have you. There's an interesting one that they found that was made in Germany sometime in the 12 or 1300s, where all of the human figures in it have birds' heads instead of human heads. So apparently the artist was aware of the problem over here, that not necessarily does everybody accept what Maharam Rutenberg says, that you're allowed to draw two-dimensional images of people. So therefore he replaced all the heads with heads of birds instead in order to have less of an issue. And that Haggadah is known nowadays. It's called the bird's head Haggadah. Okay. This is painting. This is drawings on the paper. But again, over here in the Tosfos, Maharam Rutenberg is saying that those are not a problem because they're only two-dimensional, but not everybody agrees with that. Yeah. Means just painted or drawn on the paper as opposed to three-dimensional, where it actually has a mamasha state, where it sticks out or where it's freestanding. Yeah. So Amar Reish Lakish, b'shar shenichnasu nochrim laheichel, when the goyim came into the heichel, like you said, ro kruvim amurim zeh b'zeh, they saw the kruvim hugging each other. Now, what's going on if we say that only when oisin ritzonish amakim are they hugging? So there's a few explanations. One, the Rimi Gash gives a couple of explanations. One of them is Hashem wanted to show how beloved the Jewish people were to him originally. Originally, like how it started and then how they've fallen so low. Another one, which the Ritva brings on our Gemara over here, is Fakir. It was a nest in order to further degrade the Jewish people in the eyes of the nation, that they're going to think like the Jewish people are just a bunch of lowlifes, as the Gemara is going to say over here. And then there's an explanation, Al Pi Chassidus, that the fact that Hashem caused the Churban, that's a, it talks about there, like when you have, when a Rav is teaching his, when a Rebbe is teaching his Talmidim, and then he withdraws into himself a little while in order to think of the idea how he's going to give it over to the Talmidim. So it seems like he's withdrawn from the Talmidim, but really it's only Yerid at Tzarech Aliyah. He's doing it only in order to come back closer with them and be able to explain to them on a deeper level. And therefore, that's the kind of thing when we talk about that the Shina left at the time of the Churban wasn't at, for itself, it was for a greater purpose, for eventually that there's going to be a third Beis Mikdash and a Gola Amidus Vashlema, and therefore it was represented by, at that moment, the Kruvim were embracing. Anyway, the Goyim, looking at it from a Goyish point of view, Hotzion Lashuk, they took them out to the marketplace, but Amru, and they said, what's going on with you? These Jewish people who we know all this time, we thought they're so important, when they give a bracha, it comes true. When they give a klala, it comes true. Yasku with Varam Halalu, they should be involved in such low down things. From their point of view, it looks bad. Miyad Hizulum, one of her husband and wife, to them, they only see it in the Gashmiistic way. They don't see the Ruchnius behind it. Miyad Hizulum, right away, they started thinking of the Jewish people in a more degraded way. Shenema, as the pasuk says, Kol Machabdera Hiziluha Kiro Ervasa. All of those who honored her before now thought less of her, now thought her to be degraded, Kiro Ervasa, because they saw her erva. So in other words, representing now, they saw these the Kruvim or these engravings or whatever it is, and they saw how they're embracing each other, and they thought less of the Jewish people because of that. Whereas for us, we know Fakert, it means the whole Shir Shirim is only the whole Shir Shirim, which is written in the form of a love poem between a man and a woman, is all about the relationship between us and the Eibishter. And so that kind of the love between a husband and wife is really only an imitation, only a pale shadow of the love that should be between a Yid and the Eivishter. And that's how that was represented with these Kruvim, but these guys saw it in their way. So then that would be, so again, are we talking about the Kruvim on the Aron, and we're saying that they captured the Aron and brought it to Bava, like we said before? Is it the Kruvim that Shlomo made, which were covering over the Aron, that was standing on the floor and their wings covered the Aron? In that case, also, if we say that the Aron was taken to Bava, they might have seen those. Or is it that we're talking about the Kruvim that were the designs on the walls that were painted or engraved on the walls? And in that case, fine. So they peeled off a piece and brought it outside, according to that, we'd say. Okay. So we'll continue tomorrow, Beis Hashem, and then learn about the Eben Shesia.
In the second Beis Hamikdash, there were no Kruvim.
Well, so that's what we're saying. There were no Kruvim on top of the Aron, and there weren't the two freestanding Kruvim. But in the second Beis Hamikdash, we're saying there were Kruvim, Bitsurta, there were Kruvim engraved or painted on the walls.
Yes, but there were no real Kruvim standing by themselves.
Correct.
And that is why, because they had been taken somewhere else, they had been destroyed.
Because the Aron was either hidden away under the Beis Mikdash or captured and taken to Babel. Either way, it didn't come back in the second Beis Mikdash. We learned at the end of the first parashah of Amasechta that there were five things missing in the second Beis Mikdash compared to the first one. And the first one on the list is Aron Kaporis Akruvim. There wasn't as high a level of Gilui Shechina, and there wasn't the fire on the Mizbeach, was instead of like a lion, was like a dog, and then didn't have as much effect as it used to. And a few other. There was no Ruach HaKodesh, there were no Urim V'Tumim. So yeah, there were the second Beis Mikdash was lesser than the first Beis Mikdash in many ways. Although the Gemara tells us in Bava Basra, on the other hand, it was taller than the first Beis Mikdash, and it lasted longer. Yeah. So it did have certain advantages. How much taller was it? So the first Beis Mikdash, it says, was the ground floor was 30 amos tall. The second Beis Mikdash, the ground floor was 40 amos tall.
Right. But the Kruvim, they were just placed on the Aron. They could be separated from the Aron, or they were attached to the Aron.
The Aron were attached to the Kaporis, and in fact, they were hammered out of the same block of gold as the Kaporis. Miksha Te'asa Isim, the Pasuk says. Then you have, so then you have later on when Shlomo built the first base of Mikdash, so he added the freestanding kruvim, which are two very large, oversized kruvim, 10 amos tall, with wings each 5 amos wide. They were made out of wood and plated with gold, and they stood there in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, like, so to speak, protecting the Aron with their wings.
So in the Mishkan, the kruvim were on the Pyroches, you're saying?
No, so in the Mishkan, there was only one set of kruvim, and those kruvim were on top of the Aron, attached to the kaparis, hammered out of the same block of gold as the kaparis. There is also, now, it's true, now that you mention it, you do have in the embroidery of the Mishkan, there's various places where it says that it should be embroidered or woven in the first place with kruvim designs. So I guess that would be similar to the kruvim designs that were on the walls of the Kodesh HaKadoshim that we were talking about before. But as far as kruvim, as far as three-dimensional kruvim, in the Mishkan, you only had the ones on top of the Aron. In the Beis Mikdash, you also had the wooden ones that Shlomo made. And the second Beis Mikdash, there were neither of those, only the kruvim on the walls.
Shkayach.
See ya, Shabbos.